This episode features oral argument in AMEA versus Menzies Aviation USA, Incorporated, heard before a 3-judge panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. The core legal issue is whether the defendant Menzies waived its right to compel arbitration by waiting 28 months after the complaint was filed to move for arbitration, and whether the district court correctly applied the transportation worker exemption under Section 1 of the Federal Arbitration Act to the 29 classes of workers involved in this case. The case is a wage and hour class action brought by employees of Menzies Aviation, a ground handling company at California airports. One lesser known wrinkle: this case was unfolding parallel to another Ninth Circuit case, Lopez, also involving Menzies Fuelers, and the defendant claims it strategically waited for that controlling precedent before moving to compel arbitration here. The district court found no waiver, but the panel presses both sides on whether that 28-month delay, filled with discovery, motions, and class certification briefing, should bar arbitration altogether.
The next case on calendar, Talk Desk versus FOM, has been submitted on the briefs. The final case on calendar for argument today is Amaya versus Menzies Aviation. Counsel for appellant, please approach and proceed.
Christopher Ward now begins the argument for the appellant and cross-appellee Menzies Aviation.
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Ward on behalf of appellant and cross-respondent Menzies Aviation. My hope is to have about 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll see how that goes.
Watch your time, counsel.
Very good, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honors, I appreciate that there are multiple claimed errors by the district court that have been framed up by this cross-appeal. But the starting point for resolution is relatively straightforward. It's reversal of application of the transportation worker exemption to the 29 classes of workers to which the district court applied it, which in turn requires recognition that the earlier certification order is and always has been fatally flawed. So the question then becomes, what do we do from there with the reversal? And Menzies submits that the multiple errors in how the district court went about its transportation worker analysis require a reversal with instruction to grant the motion to compel.
A motion to compel arbitration asks the court to enforce an arbitration agreement and send the dispute out of court to an arbitrator. Under the Federal Arbitration Act, arbitration clauses are generally enforceable, but a party can waive the right to arbitrate by delaying too long or by engaging in litigation conduct inconsistent with wanting to arbitrate. Courts look at whether the party knew of its right to arbitrate and then acted inconsistently with that right, for example, by actively litigating the merits in court. Since the Supreme Court's 2022 decision in Morgan versus Sundance, courts may no longer require the opposing side to show it was prejudiced by the delay.
Would you start at a step that precedes that, and that is the question of waiver of the motion to compel, where it was not brought for 28 months after the case was filed, and the other grounds that are available for waiver?
Very happy to, Your Honor. So there are a lot of circumstances at play here for why waiver is not, and the district court properly found there was no waiver here. And the first is simply what's been going on in the last 4 years. So Viking River and Saxon both come down in June of 2022. This case and the Lopez case, well, the Lopez case was filed right before that, but this case is filed right after that. And there's been a lot of transportation worker litigation as Saxon has now created this.
Saxon is a recent Supreme Court decision that interpreted the transportation worker exemption in Section 1 of the Federal Arbitration Act. That exemption excludes certain transportation workers from the Act's coverage, meaning they cannot be forced into arbitration. Saxon established that courts first define the relevant class of workers based on the tasks the worker actually performs, not the employer's industry, and then ask whether that class of workers is engaged in foreign or interstate commerce, meaning directly involved in transporting goods across state or international borders. The Supreme Court expressly rejected the argument that the exemption turns on whether the employer is in the transportation industry. The decision sparked a wave of litigation over which airport and logistics workers fall within or outside the exemption.
It's a two-part test.
What does that have to do with whether or not you move to compel arbitration?
And that's where the Lopez case comes in, Your Honor, which which you wrote the opinion on.
Yes.
So, and depending on how this court resolved Lopez, it was going to have substantial ramifications on my client's business, right? Because if the court reversed the district court and found fuelers were not transportation workers, that would have dramatically affected the scope of this potential class. If this court took a different approach and applied Saxon expansively, that would dramatically approach or affect how arbitration would affect this case. And
you really didn't seem to take a qualified view about this. I mean, you started from the beginning saying to the other side, look at all these ADR. I mean, you just started from the beginning.
What we said to the other side was, we have this ADR agreement. We believe the plaintiff is a transportation worker. They declined. They added a ramp agent to the class as a named plaintiff. The Saxon case is a ramp agent case. So at that point, the question wasn't whether this entire class was defective. It was what was going to be the scope of it. And our assertion throughout was, rather than burden the district court with how to apply arbitration when the very issue is before this court that's going to give it controlling precedent and give it guidance, it makes more sense for the district court to have the opportunity to assess how to apply it across 70 plus classes of workers with controlling guidance from this circuit.
Did you tell the district court this?
We certainly did, Your Honor. We raised it as an affirmative defense. We raised it in our 26.
Let me be more specific. Did you tell the district court that you intend to file a motion to compel arbitration, but you're waiting on the Lopez decision to come down before doing so?
My memory, Your Honor, is that in our opposition to the plaintiff's motion for class certification, we specifically said that the scope of arbitration in this case is uncertain because it is currently on appeal before the.
What does that have to do with Lopez?
And we identified the Lopez case in our opposition as this is where it's on appeal, right? But we did argue in our certification opposition, and I think this is the other.
Why file a motion for partial summary judgment on a merits issue for resolution by the court?
And if you look at that partial motion, Your Honor, what we were asking the court to do was find that that particular claim was subject to arbitration because it was covered by a collective bargaining agreement.
And right, so but that motion argued that that claim was preempted because of the collective bargaining agreements, and alternatively, that it would be outside the statute of limitations. So the relief that the motion was requesting was an end to that claim altogether, not to arbitrate it.
The relief that we were seeking there was in part to point out that this claim belongs in arbitration, not in civil court. And you can look back through the docket. We actually requested permission from the district court to file that motion to be heard at the same time as plaintiff's motion for class certification.
Class certification is the procedural step under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23, where a court decides whether a lawsuit can proceed on behalf of a large group of similarly situated people, rather than just the named plaintiffs. The court conducts a rigorous analysis of requirements like commonality, typicality, and whether the class representatives will adequately protect the interests of absent class members. Once a class is certified, the judgment binds everyone in the class unless they opt out.
And the court granted that relief. And the reason that we put that in front of the district court at that time was efficiency. What we said was because this substantially bears on the certification of this particular claim, we think it makes sense from an efficiency standpoint for the district court to understand all the issues that relate to that claim.
Well, all that may be, but that still signals an intent to litigate issues about class certification and the like. It's not a signal that you don't want to have this happen in the district court forum and you want to arbitrate it instead. So, I join Judge Fitzwater's kind of skepticism that over 28 months of litigating, and filing a motion on a merits issue, and copious discoveries, I think 7 rounds, as I read somewhere. Why doesn't that constitute waiver?
It doesn't constitute waiver because of the context, Your Honor, in that this case wasn't going to go away no matter what happened with that particular issue. And then there's, I think there's another response to that, which you sort of ask the question, if this court is to find waiver, does that essentially fatally kill our appeal? And I would submit that it does not, because we've also asked this court to pass on In re Marriott's rationale from the Fourth Circuit.
In re Marriott International is a Fourth Circuit decision holding that when arbitration will affect whether a class can be certified, the district court should decide arbitrability early in the case, as the first order of business at the class certification stage. The rationale is efficiency. Resolving arbitration issues up front helps define the proper scope of any class and avoids wasted litigation. No other circuit has formally adopted or rejected this approach, and the appellant here invites the Ninth Circuit to follow it.
And we put that in, if this court finds that that rationale is sound, and we believe that it is, then the district court should have passed on the arbitration enforceability question as to the entire classes of workers here years ago. And we asked the district court to do that. That was the basis in primary part for our opposition to certification, which is no matter how Lopez comes down, one way or another, with a 70-plus classes of workers defined or scope of definition submitted for certification, the issue of arbitration is not going away here.
You have to first move for arbitration for the district court to make that determination. To the extent you didn't move for arbitration, are you saying the district court had an obligation sua sponte to determine whether or not the proceeding was subject to arbitration?
Not sua sponte, Your Honor. I'm saying we raised it as a point in opposition to certification.
But you never filed a motion.
And in a vacuum, I could see the court's point. And if Lopez weren't going on, it might have been a different situation. Or if we were dealing with a much more circumspect class, it might be a different issue. But with some, sorry, I'm trying to do the math in my head, 6 dozen classes of workers here, that's a lot for the district court to take on in the scope of class certification, particularly when the issue is before this court for controlling guidance.
Well, you could have asked for a stay. You could have filed the motion to compel arbitration and then asked for a stay pending the outcome in Lopez.
I would have to check the briefing, Your Honor. I can't honestly recall if we did or not.
You did what?
If we had asked for a stay in lieu, right? But what we had said is this class is not properly certifiable because one way or another, it's going to contain individuals who are subject to arbitration and individuals who are arguably not. And that is a predominance question. And the district court used that for typicality.
That's part of litigation. That's the difficulty we're having here is that you were litigating those issues instead of moving for arbitration of those issues.
And I think that's where In re Marriott's rationale makes incredible practical sense and gives lower courts efficiency, right? Because what In re Marriott stands for is when arbitration is an issue that is going to affect the certifiability of a proposed class, that is something a district court should address in the first instance because it avoids all these issues, right? You don't have a waiver question anymore because it becomes much more easy to understand is there a waiver. A defendant who believes arbitration precludes certification would therefore have an obligation to say to a district court early on, hey, this is a pre-certification issue. We need to figure it out. It makes it easier for the plaintiff to understand what should or should not be included in the proposed motion for class certification. It's consistent with the sister circuit. There, to my knowledge, no other circuit has either rejected or followed the In re Marriott rationale, but other district courts have cited it with approval. And ultimately, what it would do is avoid all this argument we're having right now, because it becomes much more clear whether you waive this or what you don't and how a district court should go about assessing how arbitration and how certification can be resolved when they certainly affect each other.
Can I ask, I wanted to go back to your argument that Lopez, you were waiting for Lopez to clarify the scope of arbitration. As I understand it, Lopez affected one group of workers and there were 65. So walk me through why you thought Lopez would have such an impact that you would want to wait this long for that one group.
My belief is that fuelers are the single largest group within the 70 plus classes. So that in and of itself is significant. The other thing is that, you know, depending on how this court ruled in Lopez.
I mean, couldn't you have moved to arbitrate the other groups that have nothing to do with fuelers, even if it numerically it's a smaller group? Why? I guess I'm having trouble with understanding why waiting for Lopez for that much time was going to impact your strategy going forward.
I think the district court answered that the best, right? These are two intimately intertwined cases. I think intimately related was the district court's word, and we were reasonable waiting for that because what ended up happening is now the district court, in our view, expanded Lopez. It used Lopez to then expand from one class of workers to an entire department, which we've claimed is a BISANET violation. But that was the whole point,
That was the risk of waiting for Lopez. That's the risk that you took in waiting for Lopez. So now you have the district court using Lopez to, in your view, impermissibly expand it. So all the more reason that you should have moved for arbitration instead of waiting, because you never know what the opinion is going to say.
It's a fair point, Your Honor. I can see that. And we took the risk and it didn't go the way we wanted it. And here we are.
And that's the problem, is that it gives the appearance that you were waiting to see what happened with the litigation before moving to arbitrate. And that's something that is not looked at very benignly.
Respectfully, I disagree, Your Honor. The appearance that at least we were intending to give was litigation efficiency for all, including the district court, including my client, including the plaintiffs, because these were legal questions in a highly evolving space. This transportation worker exception has been on the books for a century. There wasn't a ton of litigation over it until Saxon comes down, and now suddenly it's everywhere.
Lopez is another Ninth Circuit case involving Menzies Aviation and its fuelers, workers who refuel aircraft. It was on appeal at the same time this case was proceeding in the district court. The defendant argues it reasonably waited for the Ninth Circuit's decision in Lopez because that ruling would provide controlling precedent on how to apply the Saxon transportation worker test to Menzies employees. The plaintiffs counter that waiting for a favorable legal development is not a valid excuse for delaying a motion to compel arbitration.
It's been up to the Supreme Court two more times since Saxon. The district courts are struggling with how to apply Saxon. The circuit courts are struggling how to apply Saxon. So our view was, given we're looking at 70 plus classes of workers, and the plaintiffs insist that the entire Menzies workforce in the state of California, no matter what they do, are transportation workers, which again, that's a BISANET problem. That is an industry-based approach. But that was their contention, is six dozen classes of workers are transportation workers merely because of who they work for. This court had yet since Saxon issued no precedent in how it was applied. I think it was reasonable, and the district court certainly thought it was reasonable to say, okay, given where the law is at and where it's evolving and where it's going right now, it's reasonable to wait for a controlling precedent from this court to assess how that's going to apply across 70 plus classes of workers. And, you know, this is different from the Hill case, where they juxtapose the 2002 agreement against the 2012 agreement. And what the Hill defendant did with the 2012 agreement is more or less exactly what Menzies did, except they never moved to compel arbitration on the 2012 agreement in Hill, and there was no waiver there. I think
if we disagree with the district court that this was a reasonable way of proceeding, do you lose?
I think I would ask the court at that point to consider whether In re Marriott should become the law of this circuit as well, because if so, if this court finds that to be rational approach to this stuff, then no, we don't, Your Honor.
Okay, if we decline to follow the Fourth Circuit and we determine that the district court's decision was not reasonable in saying that you did not waive, do you lose?
I have to concede the point, Your Honor. We would. That all said, the other thing that I would point out is that the Armstrong case also coming out, I want to say right about the same time as the Hill case, and that's what, 59 4th 1011, is very similar to this one. And Armstrong's rationale for finding no waiver there was very much tied to this area of law is evolving. And it's
what reasonable. What was the time frame there? What was the time frame that the arbitration was not pursued? How long was it?
I think it was longer than this case, Your Honor. I want to say this case was filed in August of 2022. We moved to compel arbitration at the very end of December 2024. So just over 2 years. I want to say Armstrong was a longer period than that. And in between when Lopez came down and we moved to compel arbitration, plaintiffs have made much about the 5.5 months that went on there. What they haven't pointed out is that we immediately...
Actually, I think in Armstrong, it was a 10-month gap between the filing of the complaint in October of 2017 and the motion to compel arbitration in August of 2018.
That could be correct. I don't remember. I know in Hill it was quite longer.
He said it was longer.
In Hill, it certainly is.
I was going to ask it. I think the trouble is when you're in the 2 year range, you know, Van Ness, and it's just very hard to, you know, get out of that hole you're in of saying that you're not expeditiously trying to get to arbitration.
And in a, what I would call normal litigation, Your Honors, where you don't have that exact defendant's industry being scrutinized based on new Supreme Court precedent, I would agree with you. But this is that important exception here, is that this is my own client, the exact same defendant before this case and in front, before the circuit and before the district court on the identical legal issue. And, you know, I understand the appearance. Our goal was very much efficiency. We didn't want to be back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. We wanted the district court to have the benefit of controlling precedent.
All right, counsel. We understand your argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Joe Sias, Jr. for the plaintiffs, appellees, and cross-appellants. Let me start by saying the federal policy on arbitration is to treat arbitration as an ordinary contract. No special rules favoring arbitration. That's why when an entity files a motion to compel arbitration, subject to the rules of ordinary motions, like rules on timeliness. Now, there's a prevailing federal policy in arbitration, which is stated by the Supreme Court in the Moses Cone case. It is the rapid and unobstructed enforcement of arbitration.
Moses Cone is a Supreme Court case often cited for the proposition that the Federal Arbitration Act embodies a federal policy favoring the rapid and unobstructed enforcement of arbitration agreements. Under that policy, courts should move cases to arbitration quickly, even if doing so creates some inefficiency, such as splitting issues between court and arbitration, or requiring parallel proceedings. The policy reflects Congress's judgment that parties who agreed to arbitrate should not be forced into protracted court litigation.
Even if the rapid enforcement of arbitration means inefficiency, having to have separate proceedings or issues adjudicated in different forms, what is important is that some cases that need to be arbitrated have to be taken out of the court for arbitration per agreement of the parties. That's important. That's the federal policy now. But Menzies failed to comply with that policy. In response to Judge Sanchez's question, did you, Menzies, inform the district court about we having to wait for the Lopez case before you file a motion to compel arbitration? The answer, Your Honor, is no. In the opposition on the class certification, they only cited the arbitration to say Ms. Amaya does not adequately represent the interests of the other class members subject to arbitration. And that is how Judge Vera or the district court resolved the issue of arbitration. Arbitration was seen as a procedural context here. And applying Rule 23, when the court was conducting a rigorous examination of class certification, the court said, yes, It is a common defense subject to class-wide resolution. And therefore, this is a case that should be certified. Okay. The problem is we have had four separate joint reports that I and Menzies Counsel co-authored submitted to the district court in separate occasions. None of those joint report has Menzies ever indicated that, Your Honor, we are waiting for Lopez here. That's why we're not filing a motion to compel arbitration. On the other hand, Menzies represented that other than their motion for summary judgment, they do not intend to file any other motion, including motions on issues, claims, or procedural motions. Procedural motions definitely include a motion to compel arbitration.
So, counsel, the district court was intimately familiar with all the proceedings, all of the filings, and nevertheless said there was not a waiver. Why shouldn't we give some deference to the district court's greater familiarity with the proceedings?
The thing is, that's the error that we assigned to the district court, mm-hmm. You know, for not really observing the federal policy of rapid enforcement of arbitration, because the Supreme Court acknowledges that even if you enforce the arbitration agreement, there may be some inefficiency that may follow. But the district court relied and believed rather incorrectly the argument that this is Menzies did not do this because of efficiency reasons. And Your Honor, waiting for a favorable development in law does not justify a motion to compel arbitration. We all have our own responsibilities. As a proponent of the class action, we need to file the class action immediately. As the district court has responsibility to certify or decide whether an action has to be certified or not. And the holder of the arbitration run has the responsibility to promptly bring this out to court. And if there is really a good reason for not doing it, then there should have been a disclosure to the court about it, so that at least the court can better manage its class action. The problem is they only have this disclosure of allegedly waiting for the Lopez outcome when they were confronted with a motion for summary judgment from the plaintiff's side, saying,
Counsel, would another answer to Judge Rawlinson's question be that we don't owe deference to the district court because the standard of review is de novo?
De novo review means the appellate court decides the issue from scratch, giving no deference to the district court's legal conclusion. On questions of waiver of arbitration, the Ninth Circuit reviews de novo, meaning the panel independently evaluates the facts and law without any thumb on the scale in favor of how the trial judge ruled. Factual findings by the district court, however, are reviewed for clear error, a more deferential standard.
Okay.
If it's de novo, there's no deference owed at all.
Yes.
Well, I understand it's de novo, but the district court, we often recognize that the district court, even though it's not officially deference, we recognize that the district court was in a better position to gauge the pleadings and the filings and everything, the context of everything that went on. And that's, I didn't mean deference in the sense of the standard of review. I meant deference in the sense that the district court was familiar with the context of everything that went on.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's basically, there's no disagreement as far as the facts are concerned. Okay. The pleadings, we can all see them. The pleadings do not show any transparency on the part of Menzies, any disclosure of their concerns. We believe that this is nothing but a pretext to their, right, they chose a litigation strategy in this case. They filed a motion for summary judgment seeking to eradicate the class claims. They basically conducted very active discovery, not only of the claims of the individual plaintiffs, but also of the broader class claims. And they participated in the management and direction of this class action for the last 3.5 years. That really shows acts inconsistent with the right to arbitrate.
Counsel, can you respond to opposing counsel's invitation for us to look to In re Marriott? Even if we found waiver, that the district court may have erred based on what the Fourth Circuit found in that case.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is rather unusual for Menzies to insist that we should have to decide arbitration first before deciding the issue of class certification. From a party that filed its motion to compel arbitration 28 months after the complaint was filed. As soon as the complaint was served on Menzies, they were already telling us about arbitration, and yet they chose a strategy of litigating in federal court with the hope that they can obtain the benefits of litigating in federal court.
Counsel, his argument is under the rationale of the Fourth Circuit, the district court, even if we agree that there is a waiver, that we should send it back to the district court to decide the issue on the basis that the arbitration issue should have been decided by the district court early in the proceedings. What's your response to that?
My response to that, Your Honor, is that the holder of the right should have filed its motion to compel arbitration promptly. According to the Supreme Court in Morgan versus Sundance, in analyzing waiver, you look at the holder of the right, not anybody else, but the holder of that right. Was the holder of that right diligent and prompt enough to assert its right? And I submit to you, waiting for 28 months, hoping that a favorable law will come in, is not diligence on the part of Menzies.
So it's your position that we should not grapple with the Fourth Circuit decision and try to decide whether or not it's persuasive for us to send it back to the district court to decide the arbitrability issue, the arbitration issue?
I think as a class counsel, Your Honor, faced with that situation, a district court can proceed with its responsibility of deciding whether a case should be certified or not, consistent with Rule 23, which requires them to decide as early as practicable the issue of certification. So, as I mentioned, there are three different responsibilities. The district court, to decide the issue of class certification right away. Proponent of class action, to file that class action right away. And if there's a holder of arbitration, they should have filed that motion right away. The thing is, even if you have a class certification, the district court can still determine who are the qualified members of the class. In other words, even with a class certified, there can be a refinement of the class, there can be a reduction of the class. If the court feels that some of these cases have to be arbitrated, some of these job classifications have to be sent to arbitration, the district court can still issue orders in accordance with Rule 23D and C, either to amend or modify the class definition or issue orders to govern future proceedings.
Counsel, I want to move to a different topic. Yeah. Do you think we should revisit the class certification issue on this appeal?
Your Honor, I don't think the court has pendant jurisdiction over the issue of class certification.
You don't think it's properly before us?
It's not properly before this court, Your Honor, simply because we are looking at Rule 23, a procedural framework for class action. And we're looking at the requirements of the Federal Arbitration Act, Section 1. Two separate different laws. Okay. One is not inextricably linked to the other. You can analyze the application of Section 1 exemption without having to look at certification. Similarly, you can look at class certification without looking at FAA Section 1. And the only thing, as I've mentioned with Jen Sanchez, is basically that, yes, you look at arbitration only as a common defense, only under Rule 23A. But because of different requirements and those rules, those two separate rules, they cannot be inextricably intertwined.
And I guess if we go ahead, Judge.
I was going to say, if we reverse and hold that the motion to compel was waived, what is the status of this case going forward?
Okay.
Is it a certified class as to the classifications that the district court ruled? Is that where the case goes from there?
Yes, Your Honor. Currently, the case is stayed pending the resolution of this appeal. So it will go back as a certified class. Okay. And that, regardless of what the outcome is of this appeal, there is going to be a certified class.
Thank you, Judge Sanchez.
And we haven't really talked about this, but is there any question that we have pendant appellate jurisdiction over this waiver issue?
I don't think there's any question about it, Your Honor, since basically we need to resolve the issue of waiver before that arbitration can be enforced. In other words, is the right still existing? So this court has to determine whether that right still exists. If it does not exist anymore, then you can deny the motion to compel arbitration. So that issue waiver is inextricably intertwined with the issue of the validity of this arbitration, which Menzies is seeking to enforce. By the way, talking about the stay, Menzies here requested a stay because of the pendency of this appeal. At no time before that did they ever request a stay because of the alleged waiting for the outcome in Lopez. And there was also a question with respect to how Lopez still would, or a question of whether it's reasonable to wait for Lopez, which is an issue involving one job classification, which is fuelers. And even with Lopez, you can see that Menzies still refuses to acknowledge Lopez in a way. There's still that disagreement that they had with Lopez, as I mentioned in the brief.
Your opposing counsel seems to suggest that the one classification at issue is not a problem because it was dealing with fuelers, which is by far the largest class of employees. Would you respond to that?
Sure. I believe based on the records that they produced, the ramp agents, the class under section, the Saxon versus Southwestern Airlines, still the largest class. But fuelers are still significant in number. But fuelers' responsibilities are very different from people in the other departments, like the ramp agents. So as you can see, they're different job descriptions. A decision on one job classification is not worth waiting to see if it applies to 65 other job classifications. Now, we got a complex machinery of moving and transporting persons and goods. Different workers perform different functions, all with the objective of moving or transporting people the world has become complex in a way. So, one last point, Your Honor, is that I still believe that the strategy here of Menzies is to be able to test litigation, the litigation waters, and failing to get at what it wants from the federal court, it now wants to move adjudication to a different form. We believe that's gamesmanship of the first order, which should be countenanced by, which should not be countenanced by this court. One last point on the certification order. I think Menzies misreads the certification order. Certification order is basically addressing, as I mentioned, the typicality and adequacy issues. It is not using arbitration as a basis for class certification. And therefore, again, there is no inextricable interlink between the certification order and the arbitration order. Finally, I know that under Morgan versus Sandens, prejudice is not required to oppose a motion to compel arbitration. We've been prejudiced in a way, as we pointed out, that if some of these class members are sent to arbitration, they will face that statute of limitations defense in accordance with the ADR policies of Menzies itself. So I urge this court not to allow this prejudice to thousands of class members in this case.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Let's have a minute for rebuttal. Oh, did he have 4 minutes? Oh, okay. I was trying to cheat you out of your time. Sorry.
I appreciate it. I also appreciate, Your Honor, raising the issue of the district court's familiarity with the proceedings. I think that's important, even on a de novo review standard. And, you know, I don't want to get into the weeds. I take some umbrage with the characterization of what we informed the district court and why. We certainly made it very clear to the district court that this was an issue repeatedly.
It was a strategy.
It was, and again, I understand how it can look that way. You can only take my word for it. The goal was really efficiency. I take the courts across the entire country, their time seriously. I take my clients' resources seriously.
Right. Even if efficiency is important. Think it was efficiency, that's still a strategy.
For sure.
I didn't mean to be pejorative when I said it was a strategy.
Then I totally agree with you, Anna. It was a strategy for efficiency. And again, when we talk about the district court understanding its own docket and having the sort of freedom to manage its proceedings, if there's any indication that arbitration was always meant to be an ongoing issue in this case, it's the district court. It preserved it as a basis for class certification. It said that Amaya and Silva are well situated to defend the interests as to those individuals who do not clearly fall within Saxon. So it certified the class in this case, understanding that arbitration would be an ongoing issue. And again, I understand all of the arguments from the outside looking in, but if you look at the Hill case, if you look at the Armstrong case, that is very similar to what happened here. And the district court decided that that was reasonable because the two cases were intimately related. And so if the issue is not waived, then we come to the district court Saxon analysis. And I submit that there's really not much argument that the district court Saxon analysis was flawed. At a very obvious level, it performed no frequency analysis whatsoever. It didn't even invoke Saxon's frequency element as something it needed to consider. It basically said these individuals are transportation workers because of what's put on a job description. None of those job descriptions describe how often these duties are done. And that was why when Lopez came out, and again, we weren't waiting for a favorable ruling. We were waiting for a ruling. because Lopez comes out on July 19th, 2024. We start the Central District of California Local 7-3 meet and confer process on our motion to compel in August 2024. We weren't waiting and hoping. We were waiting to see so we could make the most efficient presentation to the district court based on whatever the law of the circuit was going to be.
But you took issue with Lopez.
I continue to have, as a zealous advocate for my client, a different view than what this court reached, but we accept it. That is the law now. And until and unless somebody tells us otherwise, we will respect it, even though we respectfully disagree with it. That's just fine. That's my job. But we go back to the Saxon analysis, and if this court reaches that, there's no frequency analysis. The burden of proof of the 29 classifications that the district court exempted from arbitration, the only evidence it had from the plaintiffs on 27 of those classes were job descriptions. Saxon says you've got to look at the actual work performed by the class as a whole. I don't understand how a court can assess the actual work at a day-to-day level of what workers do by looking at a job description. And that's why we supplement.
But we often use job descriptions in that context. In Lopez, we did.
And the one thing in Lopez is there was no dispute. What do? They fuel all day long, every day. So we never raised frequency in that case because it was an obvious issue. But for many of these other positions where, again, we grouped them out in part based on frequency, because for those classifications, it mattered. I mean, the district court included people who do paperwork as workers under Saxon who are direct, actually, and necessarily engaged in interstate transportation.
But opposing counsel made the point that the classes can be massaged. Do you agree with that, that that's not written in stone, that those people are all a part of the class for all time?
And I think if this goes back to the district court, that's the argument we need to make to the district court, is you need to look at this. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that it's cumbersome, right? We tried to narrow this as much as possible, and plaintiffs said, nope, we want the entire employer in. Okay, that's why we spent 5 months meeting and conferring with them and trying to prepare an evidentiary package that would make this as easy on the district court as possible.
Now, so let me ask you this. Do you think this court should revisit the class certification issue in this appeal?
I do, Your Honor, in part because we've asked the court to undertake an In re Marriott analysis and decide if that is sound law for this circuit as well.
But separate and apart from the In re Marriott issue, do you think the class certification issue is properly before us?
I do, Your Honor, because if this court leaves nothing changed, what we're left with is at least 36 classes of workers inside a certified class that can't be there. By function of the fact that they are excluded from arbitration, they cannot be part of a certified class. So that certification order is intimately related to what happens with this case. And if any part of this arbitration, compelling to arbitration, stands, that certification order is legally defective.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much for the time, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. That completes our calendar. We would like to thank the students who have come to observe the proceedings, and we're going to go back to conference, but we'll come back later to chat with you. Okay. We're in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All rise.
The panel took the case under submission at the close of argument. No decision was announced from the bench. The court will issue a written opinion in due course, which may take several months. That opinion will address whether Menzies waived its right to arbitrate by waiting 28 months, and if not, whether the district court correctly applied the transportation worker exemption to the various job classifications in this wage and hour class action. Nothing in the argument itself predicts how the court will rule.